living again and indeed and indeed and indeed and indeed and living again and indeed and indeed and indeed and indeed and indeed and living again.
Hey Ezra, how are you doing?
Hey, I'm good, Winnie. How are you?
So Ezra, I'm in Atlanta and the days are getting shorter, but not quite as short as when I was in New York, and I managed to trip on a step in the city that has stairs everywhere and hills everywhere, and I'm walking around on crutches. One of the few things I am required to do in my job is walk in a line in public once a week. So I'm pretty embarrassed right now.
Well, I hope that you recover quickly, but embrace that limitation while it's there, you know, and see what it can teach us and see what it can teach you. I for a time, I had problems with my ears and I was effectively deaf for a few weeks. And the members of my congregation who were deaf, all of a sudden, we began to, you know, there's a sense in which I needed their community. And instead of seeing them as those that needed me, actually, I needed them and we needed one another. And there was something about that shared fragility, which was really dynamic, actually. And even once my hearing recovered to a better extent, the connection and bond with them, knowing that they knew I knew something of their world, even just for a short time, was priceless.
Powerful. I saw you just had a trip to London.
I did have a trip to London because you know what? We have these sponsors called Heart Edge that that help sponsor Gert Race. And so we went to see them to say howdy doody, and it was brilliant. Really lovely. Yeah, it was cool to be there.
And I get to meet your friend today.
Yes, you do. Coppinger Holbrook Smith is a friend. He's an actor, he's a writer, he's a thinker, he's a philosopher, he's lots of things.
He's quite famous, right?
Well, so it's funny because he's my friend, and so I knew him before other people knew him, you know. So he's my friend today, but yes, if you were to Google him, it would be full of accolades and awards for West End, doing like the Tina Turner musical as Ike. So that's really exciting. But I guess I think of him as for mate Cobner, who, you know, has been a wonderful sounding board, is part of the community of sort of godparents around one of our children. Yeah, so I guess that's how I see him. So it's funny to be able to chat to him as him, but also the, you know, says Cobner, but as Cobner as well. So yeah, I look forward to you meeting Cobner and Cobner.
Hey,
hey,
team, how are we?
Hey, Mr. Cobner Holbrook Smith, as I live and breathe. Great to see you. Hey, Cobner, I want to introduce you to my friend Winnie. She is a beautiful human being and has been a great source of inspiration to me, as have you. And so, Winnie, meet Cobner.
It's a pleasure to meet you here.
Hello, Winnie. Pleasure to meet you too.
Your background is amazing. What is that? Where are you?
I'm in my vocal booth at home. I'll show you the background really quickly. This is quite... it's quite funny. Into preferences and background sources. There you go. But even though this looks like maybe it looks like sky or something, it's actually just a quilt.
Wow. So in this podcast series, we've been starting with sort of a similar question for most people, and you can take it wherever you'd like. When you think of home today, what is home for you?
That's a brilliant question. I've been thinking about home recently because I've been in Accra, in Ghana. That's where I was born. I've spent a bit of time there, quite a lot of time there this year. It got me thinking about what shape home takes for me. And I'm increasingly starting to find an internal residence, an internal location that is about where I find comfort, where I, my work, my nature of my work, the nature of my work is such that I often have to travel and I have to be somewhere for 3 days or 2 weeks or 3 months or what have you, and it has to feel like home of some sort. So the only way to activate that stability, to really live it, is to find it inside. So home is where the heart is. So home is where my wife is, yeah.
And Cobna, I'm just wondering, if we were to bump into you as a 10-year-old, what sorts of things would you have been doing? How would you have been spending your time? Where might you have found you?
As a 10-year-old, where was I when I was 10? I was living on there's a council estate in where I grew up, in a place called Frimley. And I would have been there on the Gilbert Road estate. And I would have been, let's see, we're in November, so we'd still be in school. So yeah, I'd have been walking to school past the hospital and to Grove School with my brother or maybe some mates. And then we'd be playing, there was a green in front of the house, we'd probably be playing in the green for a little bit, but actually it'd be dark quite early, so maybe not very much, but certainly after school, just for a bit after school. I think at that stage, I think I wanted to be an author, and then I wanted to be a psychologist, and then I split the difference. Became an actor.
So what I hear from that answer is, tell me if I'm wrong, of course, is you've always been interested in people and how people work. Is that right?
Yeah. Wow. That's absolutely right. I'm crazy about it. Like, I absolutely love people, personhoods. I'm curious about relationships and society and conversations and all those facets of human interaction, really, and story. They all go together. Yeah.
Well, and you'll have to also excuse my ignorance as an American. Would you have, in the home that you described, would you have in your youth? Would you have been in a large community of people who were also immigrant?
No. I think it's a slight exaggeration, but I always crack this joke that when I got to school, there was one other black kid in the school, and it was my brother. I sort of say that a bit laughingly, but there really were very few people from immigrant backgrounds, and there wasn't much of a community. And then as I got older, my radius got wider, then I would find more people from different communities, from the black community, from East Asian communities, and so on. So it grew as I grew, but not when I was growing up. It's a very white area, very capital C conservative area.
So I'm wondering, Cobna, with your powers of observation, how did you learn to be an observer whilst you've been observed?
What, my profession, you mean?
Yeah. You know, how did that begin to grow? Because as a child, where you're just one or two of a minority in that setting, you know, you are being watched. You're in that fishbowl.
Oh, I see, yeah.
So you're being watched, but then,
learn very quickly to listen to and adapt to your surroundings. It wasn't always... There were lots of times that I felt imperiled as a child, that I've only started to come to grips with as a grown up as well, like in my 30s. And I was like, oh, right, that's why I get, you know, such and such. You know, for example, I used to often feel sort of scrutinized, or I'd be worried about how something was going to, you know, a night out was going to happen or something. And it's because... growing up, I didn't know when someone was going to maybe start something or say something or do something. And I mean, as a child, like I've had a dog set on me three times in my life, like just out of the blue as a child. So I grew up observing the situation to sort of find out where was safe and what wasn't, just keeping an alert ear out. There was a kind of alertness I grew up with, and I don't want to make it sound dramatic. It's funny, because on the one hand, see, even as I say that, I'm like, oh, no, I don't want to make it sound dramatic. That is quite dramatic. It's dramatic enough. But I did have an enjoyable childhood, but there were also these pockets of sort of danger and peril that came with it. And I think that's a part of where and how you pick up your social cues to let you know where and how you will function in the safest way in a given community. So... I remember talking to my schoolmates when I was a boy about joining the Cubs, and they just sort of encouraged me not to. And when I was a smaller boy, I wanted to join the choir. And I remember Lee Winter's mum I remember her saying, like, oh, yeah, I mean, you could join the choir, but it'd be such a shame, like, all these lovely angelic boys, and then, you know, this you on the end, kind of thing. And I look back now, and I laugh at it, but I remember just, I joined in with the sense it made at the time. I remember thinking, oh, yeah, I suppose, I mean, yeah, I suppose it would look weird in the choir. I won't join choirs, no, I don't think I'll join the choir. Yeah, I decided not to go any further with that.
So I'm just thinking about this sense of scrutiny, this sense of this place. Is it a place that you felt able to flourish, or was it a place that felt more constricted? You know, I'm curious about your sense of freedom within it.
I think it's difficult to gauge because I don't have a second lifetime to compare it to, so to speak. What I recognise now were modes of survival. Like I think I was quite a funny kid. I would try and make people laugh. I'd be an attention seeker. I would try and like learn things. Like I liked gymnastics and I wanted to be good at football. And I remember not knowing anything about football because my parents play tennis. They weren't footballers. They weren't into football as such. So when we came over, I was born in Ghana, as I said. When we came over, I was about three. We went back and forth a bit, but I remember being at school when I was about six. And I have a very clear memory of being in Bromley and just trying to figure out what football was. Like what the rules are, like running alongside, what are the rules, who should I pass it to? And I remember thinking, what is this game? How do you... And then later, after I knew the rules when I was about six, later when I was about eight or nine, when I was in Frimley, I remember having to pick a team because everyone had a team. Everybody had a you know, and Winnie, I'm sure you know, football allegiances in the UK, very serious business. You do not change your team. So you have to pick very carefully. And, you know, I remember really liking John Barnes and deciding, yeah, Liverpool were my team. So anyway, sorry, you asked about freedom. My sense of freedom was in that I felt free enough to act out and like play. And I think there's something about the scrutiny you asked about, being looked at and being examined and considered in what to me even then felt like a different way. I felt like I was examined, assessed, considered and received in a clearly different way from my peers and my schoolmates. I'm pretty sure I knew that innately. Maybe I'm retrofitting it, but I don't think I am. Having had that experience of like gauging how you're being gauged, understanding how you're being understood, I think it heightened my awareness of myself. And that is a double-edged sword, because on the one hand, it made me self-aware. On the other hand, it also made me quite egoic. It made me self-absorbed, self-obsessed, because that's the only way to survive.
Okay, so I'm just thinking in terms of the birth of the acting, the birth of the actor. So there was a psychologist thought, and then the actor begins to emerge. How did that begin to forge for you? And how did you begin to actually welcome and redeem that sense of being watched into something where you began to become a channel for a message yourself?
I enjoyed drama and I began to feel like I would like to explore more about it, but I'd never done amateur dramatics, never done anything, you know, outside of drama lessons at school. I'd never even done a school play. The first school play I did, I remember actually the year before, they did some kind of Robin Hood musical. One year they did Cabaret. And I remember I just kept singing lots of the songs from Cabaret. And somebody said to me something like, God, if you liked it so much, why didn't you audition for it? And I remember thinking, I'm going to do a play. And I think I was about 14 or 15 when I decided I would audition for a play. And I really wanted to play Judge Danforth in The Crucible. It was the worst performance of anything ever given anywhere because I could not remember the lines. And I didn't know how to learn lines. I felt like quite a grown-up 14. I couldn't have been, but I felt like one. And try as I might, I just couldn't... I didn't know how people got the lines in. I cringe when I think back to it. Somebody somewhere will have a video. If they ever release it, I'll find them and terminate them because it was so bad. So you'd think that would put me off. But actually what that did was it humbled me and introduced me to the notion of what the work is in my job. It's very much the sort of thing you start. No, I won't speak for other people. The sort of thing I started, following on from the attention seeking that was built in me as a young'un. I thought, oh, why don't I get thousands of people to look at me? I don't think I thought it consciously, but I knew that was the upshot, you know, that if I did something well, I might be clapped at. So I think I just angled for that. And then I think it introduced me to the idea that actually the real work is in the repetition, it's in the learning, and there's so much about this craft that makes it a job.
So we've talked about actors being seen. I just had a brutal read recently from a Baptist minister that said preachers, like the presumption and arrogance of a preacher and the ego of a preacher to stand in front of a community and tell them who God is, you know, and what God has to say to them week after week, and kind of brought in the ego element, which I have to admit I'd never thought about before. And you've said some interesting things about what it is that you channel and how you occupy that space. Will you say something about that?
I think there's something we have to admit to ourselves about wanting to be seen. And actors don't like to admit it. I think there's an actor called Henry Goodman who I really, really admire and has done lots of great work. And he spans lots of different genres. He does musicals, films, TV. He's really solid. He's more than solid. He's excellent. Anyway, he gave a workshop and he once spoke. He gave a workshop I attended and he spoke about this concept of the peacock and the priest. And every actor imagines themselves to be the priest. They imagine themselves to be these conduits for artistic and spiritual excellence. And all you have to do is just get out of your own way, and you'll be filled with this wonderful. It's got so many Pentecostal themes, you know, in it. Like you'd be filled with this ability and this truth, and communicate this character and inform this story, if you're just generous enough to give it room. But what it denies is the peacock, which is this wild, clownish, like, hey, look at me, kind of figure that just wants to, you know, they'll show you their arse if it'll give you a laugh or get a clap. It's there is something about that creature that is in all of us. There's like hey, you know, there's just like stacks and stacks and stacks of methods and for grabbing attention that are concealed even within the most priestly version. Like, you know, the high priest of acting is maybe Day-Lewis or I don't know, Washington or Streep or, you know, those characters. They go in, they famously do very detailed work on getting themselves into character, but all that work ultimates in the idea that they're going to be observed. It ultimates in the notion that when they say, I am such and such a character, you have to believe it, but you have to see it to believe it. The camera has to be put upon it for it to be received. There's something about being watched that is, there's this dance between the two things. Look at me, look at me, look at me. And also, don't look at me, I'm just in my truth. Oh, me, you can observe if you want. I'm just here telling the truth. Just channeling, yeah, there's nothing to be seen here. No, 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 just me living as a completely different person. Yeah.
That's really, that's wonderful. I'm wondering, can you think of a couple of characters that you have played where you've kind of felt you've identified with, and maybe you were looking to be the priest?
Always there. They're always
and maybe
tandem.
The peacock was
they're
there at the same time.
Dialogue, unison, flow, you know, conversation. Like the character I talk about the most recently is I played Ike Turner in the Tina Turner musical, and I was so proud of that show and the work and the, you know, the cast, my director Phil Adair, Adrian who played Tina. Everybody inspired me, and the peacock part of me obviously wants to know how to give the best performance on stage. I wanted people to walk away having really, really believed that I was who I said I was. The priest part of me really, really worked hard on the boring stuff. Every time somebody asks me to give advice, I say hard work isn't hard. It's not the difficulty of hard work that makes it hard. The thing that makes hard work hard is it's tedium. Going over your lines yet again, practicing guitar, being ready to remember that choreography, be natural, your movement, your voice, your everything, all the different elements that have to be, you know, run through again and again and again so they're polished enough to seem natural, to seem like you're indifferent, to seem like you're relaxed, to seem like you are, you know, you're in the situation you say you're in. That's where the priestliness is. That, and I imagine for actual priests, I don't know if it's like preparing sermons, doing all the theosophical and theological work you do to understand the basic question from a six-year-old, you know, you need that theosophical grounding to be able to say, well, actually, it's not as simple as that. Yeah, and you need the. This is a friend once told me that the definition of excellence in art is the ability to convey complexity. When you look at a painting, even if it's, you know, Picasso's Blue Period, which are very simple, very plain, one, you know, blue and white, it's actually the detail, the complexity of the curves of the body, or the fact you can really recognize a face even though it doesn't look like a conventional face. That's complex, but it comes across in a really facile way because art, the genius of art, is conveying these complexities, these spiritual, these emotional complexities. And I think what can be more complex than the very concept of the divine, and how to bring that to people who are ready to receive it. You've got willing audiences, you've got people, you know, congregations, I mean, you've got people who are there, ready, willing and able to receive these notions, to receive this concept, to exist in this spirituality, but you still have to make it palatable and appreciable for them. And I think that's where the parallels lie. Wait, has something happened?
Hey, Azariah, I think we've lost Kabna for a moment. While we're waiting, I'll just ask you this. You know, Nadia Boltz-Weber talks a lot about the fact that salvation happens in your body. It happens to embodied people, right? It happens in these lived experiences. So, which, of course, is obvious, but I find actually very compelling theologically. That's not how we talk about our souls often, right, and our spirit. But what we've heard a conversation about what it means to open ourselves to spirit, really to, I mean, it was a very Pentecostal conversation, I feel like we just had. So clearly there's lines and there's discipline around it in the same way that I would think as a clergy person, you observe a discipline about your preparation, right, and being present, and then present in that community to the needs and feeling of that community so that what you've prepared can, I'm assuming for you, right, can be in that space in the right way. Do you resonate with how he describes a preparation process and occupying that space?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. So when I distribute the sacrament and I look people in the eye, there's a sense in which I'm hoping that I'm mediating something to them, I'm imparting something to them. And actually, I really enjoy it when there's children or adults who choose a blessing instead of the sacrament, and I get to say a short prayer for them. And it just feels that there's, I'm hoping that I'm holding something, that the words that I say will actually detonate truth and hope within them. And that when they leave, there's something, you know, so I'm hoping that I'm being a channel for goodness, for grace with them and for them. I think I'm curious, Winnie, I wonder what you think of. So when Cobner's speaking about playing Ike, you know, Ike is a complex character. There's some dark sides there. And I wonder how you accommodate the dark sides that come with the role that we're part of as well, you know?
But I want to ask him that question, because how do you sympathetically enter a character that's really difficult to be compassionate towards, right? And play them, I think that part is fascinating, right? Play them truthfully for a person seeking their way. I feel like we preach that lesson all the time, that we're all trying to make our way. But you know, what I find, we were just talking about this here recently, when we do hard work, right? When we talk about race and power and what it means to exist in the communities that we're in ways that are just and moving communities towards justice and compassion, you can feel in the room as you walk into that room, right? And as you can feel the tension and pressure, and it's my own worry about what's possible, but you can feel in this room that this isn't where we've been before, and how we move together and taking that in to find a place to start with whatever I've prepared to be emotionally present enough in conflict is, I think, for me, is one of the most interesting parts of being in this role.
Constructively. Yes.
But Kavna, are you
he's
back?
He's back. Yeah.
But tell us about
being
Art Turner. It's
interesting. I caught some of the last bits of what you're saying about being present and how to... play somebody complex, you know, I caught that and I didn't want to interrupt, but there are parallels. I touched on the idea of lenses, of different ways of looking at things. The basic concept is that if you look at science, you need to use, for example, the Newtonian constant to understand natural physics, but it won't help you in quantum physics. You need to use something different to look at quantum physics, but only down to the level of quarks. After quarks and whatever, then you have to use a different kind of lens. And you use string theory or whatever, or, you know, all the ideas, dark matter, that you all need different lenses in order to understand them. There's no point in trying to find one way of doing things. And it's the same for me in playing characters, and I imagine it's the same with approaching divinity. I think it's Rob Bell that said something about you can only approach, you can only expect to understand divinity, to write about divinity through poem, because it's too vast to commodify in a structuralist way. And then the last sort of maxim I would offer is that there is, if it's not practical, it's not spiritual. So, you know, if again, borrowing from Fowler's Stages of Faith, if you've got these ideas of what is true and good and divine inside of you, that's all well and good. But unless you can share those concepts with someone else, it's only you having them. So there's a dichotomy where your experience needs to spread outwards in order to be in many ways validated, shared, activated, but it also has to remain inwards in order to be alive in you. So there's this constant push and pull between practical and spiritual. Character, playing a character that is unpleasant, you can only play, or I could only play, a character that mean and flawed through love, through the lens of love and adoration. It sounds counterintuitive, but you can't just play bad. You can't just elect to go, oh yeah, I'm just going to be mean. I'm just going to be someone who lashes out. In order to really play it, you have to make sense of the lashing out in a loving way. And that's a new dichotomy. That's a new understanding. I in my research, like I looked up YouTube videos and I looked up transcripts, and they had transcripts for us of conversations from various people in Tina's life and Ike and so on. I read his autobiography, and the sense he had of what he did, the physical violence he inflicted, was a sense of nurture and care. He never quite acknowledged. For example, he would say that he never beat Tina up. But he would readily admit that he smacked her, slapped her, punched her, hit her, all those things, thinking that that's okay, that that was an acceptable thing. In one of the interviews, he talks about how he thought it would like perk her up, and he made this gesture of like a slapping hand to suggest that, you know, she'd be sad, she'd be moping around the house, and he thought he would like ginger her up in some way. So to play it and make it make an internal sense for me, without if I tried to play it without that internal sense, if I tried to play it without connecting in that way, it would only have been plastic. You just, you know, it's like just twirling one's moustache and swirling one's cape and saying, I'm bad, you know, to present badness. But to live it, it had to feel and seem like the best course of action to take at the time, the most loving course of action to take at the time. Yeah, and that was that approach. I've played other characters where, when I play characters that were especially generous or gentle or kind, I play a lot of priests and police. I play a lot of ministers and a lot of coppers. I don't know why. I don't get it. I am an atheist and I'm not in the police service. However, there's something someone sees that maybe I don't, but maybe I'm getting messages, yeah. Anyway, if I leave here and become a police chaplain, you'll understand why.
Well, you know, a little bit of what that resonates with is, I feel like as a preacher, there are these characters in the Bible that are just monstrous, right? But if we engage them fully, part of what it provokes in us, and clearly many characters in the history of the church, right? But what it provokes in us is a deep awareness of our own capacity for harm and for self-delusion and evil, right, to justify ourselves. And it's and that the text is full of that. And we've sort of cleaned them up so that we can, but it's right there in the text, right?
Yeah,
that,
I completely agree.
There's the human reality.
I remember quoting this quite a lot. I'm sure Azariah's heard me say it before, but in the Book of Kings, when it talks about David and his jealousy, was it jealousy of Jonathan, right? No, am I getting my kings mixed up? Whomever, it said the evil spirit, no, it was Saul, no. Saul. It was Saul uh-huh. who was jealous. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, jealous of David, that's it. The scripture says, the evil spirit from the Lord came upon him. It situates the evil, it situates the malevolence as emerging from the love, from the divine source of love. And I think there's something interesting about that. I think there's something about how we live as human beings and where we get our energies from, where we get our behaviors from and our malevolence from.
This is fascinating. And Cobra, I'm just wondering, you know, something of your journey from being atheist to being atheist and how you hold that mystery now. I find that curious, you know, I'm curious to hear some of that journey for you.
Thank you. I love that turn of phrase, mystery, because that's, yeah, you know, and I don't know when they stopped, but they used to call the love, the divine love, the experience of divine love and grace, mystery, God's mystery. And it's also another turn of, it's another term for profession, isn't it? What is your mystery? It means, what's your profession? Used to be. For me, I jokingly call myself a faithiest because I have this, I just act as if. I act as if there is a God of my understanding, a divine power, that a higher power that can love, guide, protect, what have you, me. But if I get rational about it, if I try and compose a disquisition that proves or disproves the existence of a God, I end up in a quagmire. So instead, I just act as if. I just act as if there is a God. And my theory is, if there is, then it's a better thing than if I act like there isn't and there is. This isn't to do with retribution or to do with hellscapes or anything like that, or being in the, you know, the right in-group. It's just, for me, it feels like the best connection to love and to a lived reality that is generous and human and connected. That to me seems like the most likely way, the most useful, loving way to live. A big thing, it's also, to my mind, a better way to make mistakes than the other way, because we will make mistakes. I will F up and have done for most all of my life at some stage or other. There's always a mistake to be made, and I'll be there clavicle deep in the muck, right? I'm aware of that. And I think that if I believe in horrific punishments as a result of every misdeed, every peccadillo, I don't think I'd be very happy, sane, or alive. But if I believe in love and I believe in rolling redemption, redemption from any pit, redemption from any sin, any misdeed, any what have you, recognizing, apologizing, moving toward the good, then yeah, it feels better. And having a sense of something being good and powerful is another interesting thing. I was talking to a friend recently about this notion of higher powers and what goodness looks and feels like, and how much it doesn't look and feel to me like dominance. It doesn't look and feel to me like control or stricture. It looks and feels to me like nurture, like love, like nourishment, like joy. And that is something I'd rather be subordinate to joy than, you know, rectitude.
I feel like the one comment I have to say for what you just said in the last section is you've described being a very good Anglican, to live in the as if. You know, what you've described is sort of classical Anglicanism, right? To live in the as if, You know, it's a good question. What does it mean to believe? What does it mean to know? What does it mean to logically try to explain the great mystery of the sacred and of love? I think for most of us, we try to live as if, and that these texts are the ones that we'll organize around, but we live as if. So thank you.
That's brilliant. Kobna, I'm just wondering, what's coming up for you? What's exciting? What work are you engaging at the moment? And how is that process opening you more to love, to joy?
I'm currently filming the Wonka film. It's a prequel to the Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory film from however long ago. And I'm learning a lot about... I'm working with lots of incredible people that I look up to before I'd even met them, and now I look up to even more. Timothy Chalamet is, you know, energetic and like intelligent and sweet and generous. Keegan-Michael Key is inventive and brilliant and detailed. His improvisation is, I've never seen anything like it. It's second to none in, as far as I've seen, in terms of its scope and its humor and its range. And I'm learning how to serve other actors on camera. I'm learning how to work in a way that still keeps my character intact, still keeps me in play, but leave space for people like Keegan to do their work. Does that make sense? I think I do that anyway. I think I tried to do that anyway. I would never try to like hog a spot or a gag or what have you. But there's a balance between playing in a way that helps tell the story, helps deliver the gag, helps to fortify whatever you're doing, whatever gesture you're making. But there are also ways that you can just be you. You just do your thing and it'll be what it is and everyone else can arrange it. But having that consciousness is something that I've enjoyed exploring on this particular job, where it's a bit more collaborative. It's got sort of theatrical feel in that sense. Like, I think, yeah. And I think that spreads out into society and into life. I said earlier, if it's not practical, it's not spiritual. I've got two tenets that inform my idea of higher powers and divinities. One is that if it's not practical, it's not spiritual. The other is that you cannot expect to experience grace except through other people.
Say that line again, because you got the tagline.
It's like a theology class.
You cannot expect to
except through other people.
That is amazing. Wow. Oh. Wow. Thank you so much. Well, we have experienced grace through you today. So thank you so much, Kobna.
Thank you, Winnie.
Thank you.
Thank you. Wonderful to be in conversation with you here. Thank you.
And thank you, Rosie. I know you don't like to be, so I left a little gap so you get the scissors in, but thank you very much.
Kobna Holbrook-Smith was talking to Winnie Varghese and Azariah France Williams. Randolph Matthews composed the music. Grace was produced by me, Rosie Dawson, and is a Heart Edge production. You can find more episodes wherever you get your podcasts from or from heartedge.org. Do listen, review, and share grace with your friends.